The Fearless Podcast, in a time of deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act.
Hey, Miniscari, welcome to the Fearless Podcast. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm really excited to have you on. And maybe how we can start out is if maybe you could give us a little bit of history and background on yourself and kind of what led you to what you're doing today.
Sure thing. First of all, apologies if you can hear the snowplow in the background. I'm in Whistler. It's for you Americans. It's about 5 degrees Fahrenheit up here, so it's freezing cold. I was born in Iran in 83. I was fortunate enough. My parents got me out of there. And we've been bouncing around the world all over the place. We were in Germany for a while. I grew up on the west coast of Canada in Vancouver. I was over at the East Coast for university. I've lived in England. I've lived back in the Middle East. And I've lived in Spain as well. I always just wanted to have a carefree life. And, fate had different plans for me with after your 2020 election. I got absolutely obsessed with American media. And then when I saw how bad things were going in Canada, I got obsessed with Canadian media. And then I figured at some point I had to run for public office. So I'm running for your version of congressperson for the People's Party of Canada.
Interesting. So what's your background work-wise? What were you doing prior?
I was always a nerd growing up in high school, and I went to computer science in university. And then I landed a project installing data centers, but it was very small. We're not talking Amazon level. Small data centers, installing cameras for stadium security. It's sort of mall security kind of thing. But I really liked the project management aspect of it. And I also like the freedom that comes with having your own company. So you have to work like three times as hard, but it's your company. You don't work for someone else.
So you had your own company?
I did. Yeah.
Great. Yeah. I've had my own company, and it's that will motivate you to be politically active when I'm originally from the Northeast. We actually, today is our 11th Texas anniversary, where we fled the communist oppression of the Northeast coast for Texas for a better life, a more simple, intentional, agrarian, agricultural lifestyle. And I had a construction company up there, and I was working basically to pay taxes and insurance premium. And I made a lot of money, but so much of it went to taxes and insurance premium. And property taxes were so high. We decided 11 years ago, if we're going to make a better life for our children, and since in America we have the ability to walk to freedom, maybe we should just change our geographical location in pursuit of a better way of life. So we did that 11 years ago today. And it was a great decision. And so you are a business owner, and now you are running for political office. I thought it would be really neat if we could talk about, I want to listen to a soundbite real quick. I hope all my technology is working here. I wanted to listen to a soundbite real quick of a recent debate Tucker Carlson had to kind of set up our conversation, a recent debate that Tucker Carlson had with Piers Morgan.
We're going to have to whack the farmers and punish all these groups of people. And everyone was like, wow, you've waited 14 years in opposition, and this is what you're doing?
What did
the
farmers do wrong? I never understood that.
They make our food. I mean, it's ridiculous. Most of them live literally...
Because British food's not good? Was that
the most problem? Of them lose money, farmers. And the idea, he created the impression that a lot of pensioners can afford it, a lot of farmers can afford it. Actually, most of them can't. Most of them can't.
But why would you target farmers? I mean, it's just...
Inexplicable.
But it's happened throughout Europe and the United States, attacking farmers. And it seems like part of a
should
bigger...
reward farmers. Farmers are the lifeblood of any
but
civilized
I guess what
I'm country.
Saying is, right, but if you're looking big picture, if you're opposed to famine and you're for human flourishing and people, then you'd want to do whatever you could to have enough food.
I agree.
And if country by country by country, Germany, Great Britain, Denmark, Holland, they're all attacking farmers, United States, maybe there's a bigger anti-human agenda at work. Do you see that?
I just think it's a pretty dumb political agenda that's been pursued so far.
It's not just dumb, it's like weird.
Yeah.
Of all the groups you'd attack, why farmers?
Makes no sense.
And it does make sense, though, doesn't it?
Why?
Well, clearly there's an effort to reduce the human population. If all these countries,
he wants to starve the Brits and kill us.
Well, I don't know. I don't. You know, you can't assess the motives of individuals; they're unknowable.
He's not trying to starve the British people.
Okay, I don't know him. I don't know what he's trying to do.
That's all I'm talking.
No, you come on. Look around the world, government after government after government around the world is endorsing policies that they know will reduce birth rates, is attacking agriculture. And is allowing, I don't know, drugs and food that kill people and make them less healthy. So if you add that all up, you don't have to know their motives. You just look at the effects and you're like, the effect is to kill people.
All right. So I thought that would kind of set up our conversation. And the reason why I wanted to have this conversation is you're my neighbor to the north and we're from different countries. And so I thought it would be kind of an interesting conversation because here, you know, Tucker kind of connected some dots and he was talking about how this appears to be some type of an agenda. And so first I wanted to just kind of get your thoughts and feelings on what you see going on in Canada with your farmers and your food production. And are you seeing the same thing that we're seeing here in America?
Yeah, we are. So there's something here called supply management. Basically, what they're saying is we have to regulate how much milk you produce, how much eggs farmers sell. So what the government does with the interest rates, where they say if we don't moderate the interest rates, then things will explode and the price will fall. They're doing the same thing here with milk, with poultry, eggs, things, a whole bunch of other things too. And it's not a very efficient system because it's a command economy and it's always the small farmers that get hit first. So yes, they're doing it here too. And I have a theory as to why they're going after farmers, because farmers are self-sufficient. Like, you could plonk a farmer down on a farm, they could survive for a decade. You know, you have well water, you have your own food, you only need a little bit of electricity. This is the exact opposite of what these globalists, technocrats, academics, these idiots that come out of these university institutions want. They want full control. So if you have lab-grown meat, it's not that it tastes better or it's more nutritious, but, you know, Wall Street has invested $1 billion in that lab and the city mayor decides when, the lights come on and off. I think that's what's going on.
Yeah, it's all about control. And what's more interesting to me is it's definitely a global agenda where country after country, whether it's US, whether it's Canada, whether it's the Netherlands, we're watching these things happen. And another interesting thing, by keeping a larger worldview and paying attention to things that go on in Canada and the Netherlands, is a lot of times we can kind of catch the trend before it happens here, because a lot of these things get test marketed overseas and in Europe and even obviously in Canada. You guys progressively are slightly ahead of us. And that's why I thought it'd be real interesting to kind of get your feedback. So with this assault and attack on farmers, politically, what kind of solutions do you think, what should be implemented?
I mean, the implementation, let's roll it back this way. Let's see where the attacks are coming from. In Canada, actually globally, what did they try to do through the World Health Organization? The pandemic treaty? Yeah, it had something to do with pandemics, but also they put in there the food supply, you know, animal health. So they wanted more control. That fell flat on its face. And they came to Canada and they said, all right, if we can't do it internationally, let's try to roll it out federally in Canada. And there was a bill called C-293, which basically, it was a pandemic treaty, but pushed through Ottawa. And it's going to do the same thing, that one health approach where they're trying to connect health, human health, to animal health, to plant health, to the food supply. So that's another area. Municipally, they're going after farmers through regulations. So there was in Alberta, there was a small hamlet and they said, like, you can only have this many chickens. You have to get a permit if you want to put barbed wire around the chicken coop. If you want to create a chicken coop, you need a permit. So they're coming at it from different areas and you're asking me what's the solution. I'm sort of, the libertarian in me says it's pretty obvious, just less government. Defund them. Maybe some criminal convictions for these bureaucrats that trespass on your property.
I am very much for less government. And the reason that I don't have as much hope as everyone else has right now is I keep seeing new parts of government. Like, now there's a Department of Government Efficiency and Now there's an external revenue service. I keep seeing more government, and I do. It does, you know, maybe this, everybody's required to be back at work. I think it's February 6th. So maybe this will be a large part of the reduction of government. But I love it when I hear someone say that the agenda, I think relatively speaking, almost every problem can be solved with less government because there's less bureaucracy, there's less people, less power trips, less litigation, less laws to muddy the waters and muck up the work. So you would be much more in line with regarding the reduction of government, what kind of percentage are you thinking would be an ideal percentage to reduce government?
Off the top of my head, in Canada, not, I don't know about America, but in Canada, I would say 80%. Like if you
80%.
I would start from the ground up. I'd say, all right, we have a criminal court. So criminal law we need. And then what else can we get rid of? Like we have executive courts in Canada. I don't know if you have these in America. I think your EPA, for example, for the longest time did act as the judge, jury, and executioner. In Canada, we have these things called Canadian Human Rights Tribunals. So if I say I don't like your man bun, instead of going dragged in front of a court, I get dragged in front of these human rights commissions that are underneath the executive and nobody's questioning them. I just get
it's
rid
like
of
star
all of those.
Chambers or something. That's wild.
It is. Yeah. It's like a star chamber. And if you're on the wrong end, like if you're a straight white male, you're usually going to end up losing. Sometimes they bring evidence against you, but they don't show you the evidence.
Wow.
You're not appointed. If you can't afford a lawyer, you're not appointed one. It's weird.
So you have to like represent yourself, I guess?
I've never gone into one of these, but typically what happens is if somebody brings a case against you in the human rights tribunal, you're just like, you know what? I'll settle. Like you got a woke judge.
Wow. That's crazy. So 80, I could really get on board with an 80% reduction of government because so there's so much bloat in our government. And if defend our borders, I'll even give you deliver the mail, defend our borders, deliver the mail and leave us alone. And if you do that, I think America would be a much better place. Hey, I'm a Texan. You know, we're kind of independent and we're kind of like, you know, leave us alone. So I could really get on a political campaign that was expressing the idea of the reduction of a federal government by 80%. And then, you know, start with the feds and then we can work on our, you know, we're not perfect as a state and we have lots of work to do and lots of fat to trim, but start with the feds and let it trickle down. I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, there's just so much. Like, let's take healthcare because that's the one of the up a handful of things that separates America from Canada. The other one is guns. So in Canada, we have, they love to say that we have the best healthcare system and we have a healthcare system. We don't have a healthcare system. We have a health insurance system. So everybody pays into the government health insurance and then the government pays out to the different private hospitals and clinics. There's two problems with that. One, if you're rich, when I say rich, like if you have $100,000 and you can afford to go buy private health insurance, the government, you should do that privately. The only time you have health insurance from the government is if you can't afford it, you know? You don't want people dying on the streets. I get that. But then we have a command economy system where they say like, oh, you broke your leg, that's $11. You broke your nose, that's $17. It's completely arbitrary. I call it Soviet. It's like the old Soviet Union.
Wow. It's so interesting you talk about healthcare. Because at one point in time, we did have a healthcare system. I like the way that you describe the Canadian version, because basically now, since Obamacare and since it never got rescinded for whatever reason, we basically have the exact same thing, you know, and a single payer model, the forces that puts on that ecosystem. You know, basically, I see it as an end around to single payer, and it's just designed to collapse the system, and shortly we'll be kind of lockstep where y'all are with a single payer. But ours is rapidly getting close to that. Fortunately, there still are free market options. I recently had the CEO of CrowdHealth on, so that is a private health sharing cooperative, like a crowdsourcing for your healthcare. And so there's some really neat solutions that are being brought to the free market. Healthcare insurance as a whole right now in America is very much kind of like a single payer, because when Medicare and Medicaid and then these private healthcare companies, all basically all the prices are being driven by, you know, Obamacare, the infrastructure that is Obamacare.
Yeah, let's take a trip through history. We didn't always have healthcare, universal healthcare. It started out in the 40s. This guy, this premier, our version of a governor, Tommy Douglas, he just campaigned on it because it was the Great Depression. And he said, vote for me and I'll give you, you know, free healthcare within our state province. And he won. And I think every other politician realized, they're like, well, why don't we just all campaign on that and we'll all get elected? So it got bigger and bigger and bigger. And then somebody stumbled on the fact of, wait a minute, how do we differentiate ourselves from Americans? Well, we're Americans, but with healthcare. So now it's a part of our national identity and it's very difficult to get rid of it. So fast forwarding to Obama. Obama's kind of done the same thing. There was some funny business with one of the senators. Apparently, like, he needed his vote and they stole the election. I think it was Al Franken, but I could be wrong. But anyway, so they managed to get this bill in, Obamacare. And then Trump came in and he tried to remove it, but he couldn't. Now it'll be interesting to see if in his second term, where he's got a lot more political power, he'll be able to do it, but he has to replace it with something better, unfortunately. Otherwise, you're stuck with it.
Right. That's kind of what's fascinating, is that there are free market options now. We've been participating in medical sharing for well over 20 years now. And so we've been with three or four different providers. They've all been very easy to use. And now with technology, and with companies like a CrowdHealth, where they have an app and you can do everything on your phone within a couple minutes. And then what they're finding is that these doctors and institutions like working with people that are basically direct paying, because, you know, when you deal with insurance, you're usually dealing with like a net 90 or a net 120 pay. And these doctors are like, wow, well, basically, you're a cash patient. So we can negotiate with you directly. We'll get paid directly. You'll get your service. We're happy. You're happy. I mean, that's a real solution. In Canada, being that it's kind of like almost like you're saying baked into the culture, how would you unpack that?
Very delicately. So the way you start, the last thing you want to do is say, we want to get rid of healthcare. That's like saying we want to get rid of your pensions and people lose their minds. So the first step is to do a two-tier system, what America used to have before Obamacare, where, you know, everybody buys their own private health insurance. If you can't buy it, the state provides it. And the way that you sell that is you say it helps. A two-tier system allows people who have the money to, if they want faster treatment, they can get it. And once they do that, it clears up the existing healthcare system so you can get it faster as well. To me personally, that's basically an admission of saying that, you know, our healthcare system sucks. It's completely bogged down and that's why it's so slow. So we're going to let them pay for a little bit faster service.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think that's a viable solution. You know, I'm very much very libertarian and very small government, and I don't like any kind of government subsidy or anything like that, or any kind of government program. And the reason I say that is because it always gets so manipulated and so corrupted and so extorted, you know, because really the government is like a neat and clean version of the mob. But I honestly don't have a problem with a healthcare option that's paid for by the government for those that can't afford it, especially when your government wastes trillions of dollars a year. I think it would be very simple and easy. We could easily take the money that we're sending to incinerate Gaza, and we could take those dollars and easily provide health care for everyone that can't afford it. You know, if we would stop just sending our monies overseas to like incinerate people, if we stop doing that, then we could talk about, oh, well, let's reduce spending more. But while we're policing and blowing up the world, I'm very much, you know, I don't really have a problem with that type of system that would provide for those that can't provide for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, you touched on a lot of things. I think Donald Trump kind of, he realized this in his first term, and now he's, you know, he's more emboldened to stop all of these forever wars, he calls. You're slaughtering people. Yes, you're going to get blowback, like more terrorism reprisals. But if you look at it like from a dollar perspective, when you send $1 to blow up Afghanistan, I don't think you're getting back $1 ROI. Like it's just a waste of money. Or at the very least, it's a transfer of money from taxpayers like yourself to some weapons arms manufacturer when you could spend that money on healthcare, education, the homeless, you know, the veterans.
Yeah. And I mean, I make the contention that pretty much everything that the government is involved in is a transfer of wealth, just like the way that they're so embedded into Wall Street with the plunge protection team and with all of the supposed tax incentives with retirement accounts, whether it be pensions or whether it be 401ks. You know, the government never gives you a perk without strings attached to it. And ever since they went away from defined benefit packages to defined contribution, I just saw that as a way that the lobbyist groups, the Wall Street lobbyists, created a way to force more dollars into the market. Prior to doing what I do now, I was a financial advisor for 11 years. And, you know, I would do the client intake and there would always be a risk tolerance analysis, right? So you had to answer these questions. And what is your risk tolerance? We're going to base your asset allocation on your risk tolerance. And what I've found from being involved in the market when the dot-com popped and then in 08 when the housing market popped, what I experienced is that 95% of our clients, we dealt with some pretty high net worth clients, but 95 to 98% of our clients did not have the risk tolerance to even be in the market. And because they would always buy high, they would listen to their neighbor, they would listen to Harry when Harry had the hot stock tip and they would buy high. And then when there was a huge correction, they would sell low. And yeah, I don't think that most people should be in the stock market. And really, the stock market, in my opinion, is just a wealth transfer so that Vanguard, State Street, BlackRock, Blackstone, that's what's enabled them to basically buy up all these board seats on every other company that you've ever heard of, as well as all this commercial and residential real estate.
Yeah, I mean, some of this is out of my area of expertise, but I was watching your interview with Matthew Arrett.
Yes.
And he was actually, you and him were having a fascinating conversation about this. So I look at things like BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street Capital. It is just a massive concentration of wealth and power. And I'm thinking, like, how did we get here? Now, Canada is, I don't want to be quoted on this, but I feel it's worse, like our concentration. We have like two or three big banks, two or three big telecommunications providers. And just, I've been living in this country since 89. Since the 90s to now, the level of misery has gone up in Canada because you don't really have private entrepreneurs anymore. All the private practice doctors and architects, they're getting wiped out and gobbled up by the big guys. And you don't have that entrepreneurial spirit that you and I were talking about when you have your own company. So what's happening high level at Wall Street, which you just identified, I see it happening low level in our communities.
And so what do you think politically when it comes to like creating laws or regulation, what are your ideas as far as how to counteract that?
It's a good question. It's a tough question. So my first thing is like adding laws. We have so many laws in Canada, you have to be careful. I would almost rather have some sort of constitutional amendment to create like a two-tiered society where the revenue agencies could almost say, if you make less than $1 million in revenue, you're tax exempt. You don't have to do any bookkeeping, none of that. So you got to wall it off so that the little guy doesn't get crushed. And I'll tell you what I mean is like a lot of these laws, the big guys can absorb them. Empty homes tax. We have something in Canada called empty homes tax. What's happened is a lot of these Chinese nationals, they've come to Canada and they're buying up the land. It's driving up the cost of land. So what they said is every year you have to declare your empty homes tax exempt. So now if you're one guy who's got one apartment, and there's three of these laws, municipal, provincial, and federal. So every year I got to take the time off my schedule to make sure that I declare this empty homes exemption, or I get hit with like a $100,000 fine. BlackRock can handle that. They'll just hire a team of 10 people. They'll pay them a salary. If I forget to do that, which I did once, I got hit with a $60,000 fine.
Man.
Like these things happen. I don't like those types of rules that the big guys can navigate, but the little guys can't.
Yeah, and it's very similar here. It's very similar with China buying up. China's bought up a huge swath of land here in Texas, and it's very similar here with these different types of bizarre regulation that are just making it impossible for the everyday person, the blue collar, even white collar guy to exist and subsist. Yeah. And when I said what kind of laws, I'm thinking more of political deconstruction in the sense of obviously getting rid of laws and creating less regulation so that average normal people can come up with an idea and then bring it to market and bring their solutions to the market, and then everybody can participate in that. And that way, I mean, that's how you solve problems in a free market economy. You bring your solutions to the market, and then the people make a choice by voting with their dollar.
So when I said that more laws is not always a solution, I'll give you an example why. So one good knee-jerk reaction that you and I would probably initially agree with would be to say a law that people can't own more than $100 million worth of land. You know, like you said, a number, right? So you don't get Bill Gates coming in and buying up all the land. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, what's happened is Canada, we have so many communists in our government that they'll turn around, they'll be like, well, instead of 100 million, why don't we make it 100,000 so nobody can own land and the government owns it?
Yeah.
So that's what I meant when I said a constitutional amendment. Like you want to say something that, you know, this is the intent, this is our manifesto. So that some legislature that's, you know, Nancy Pelosi or the squad can't just come in and destroy the foundations.
Let me ask you this, because you're kind of involved and you're paying attention to U.S. politics. What are your thoughts, okay, from a constitutional perspective? I mean, I understand the talking points of why it's being done, but if you come in and to fix everything, you just use executive order, wouldn't you think that as soon as you're not in power, basically, if the tide turns, wouldn't the other side just undo everything with an executive order?
I mean, they could. That's what Trump did with Biden, what Biden did with Trump, what Trump did with Obama.
Yeah, like the way I see it is like it's a complete deconstruction of the way that our country was established with checks and balances, like with the three branches, and all these branches were supposed to... And what I see potentially coming to America is basically our Congress becomes such political theater that eventually they'll be like punching each other like in Europe and stuff. And because they'll become so irrelevant, because if whoever is president can just do everything with executive order, I mean, it really makes Congress kind of irrelevant, don't you think?
Does. What you're describing is the growth of the administrative state. That's what we call it in Canada. You guys might call it the bureaucratic state. You guys are kind of going in the right direction. You just repealed the Chevron defense, the Chevron mm-hmm. doctrine. So that's a step in the right direction. But like the government is just so large and they're passing so many regulations every day that you're making the legislature moot. So the legislators, your congresspersons, they love that. Because if some anonymous person in some agency passes a regulation, that saves that legislator, that congressperson, the egg on their face for having had to introduce that through the Congress. They might, you know, the people might see that. When it's done through the government, they don't see that. So that's sort of the mechanism that's driving this. It's not that the congresspersons want to put themselves out of a job. They're in a way, they're very cowardly. It's an abdication of responsibility.
Yeah, I never thought about it like that. That's a good point.
I read a lot of your American news.
So what other major issues in Canada do you think have to be addressed within the next year or two?
We have, our system of government is sort of like yours, where we have Congress and we have Senate. Now, the rules are a little bit different, but the Senate is sort of like it's the gatekeeper of the laws passing through. Unfortunately, unlike you guys who elect your senators, our senators are appointed by the Prime Minister, Trudeau. So Trudeau has appointed a whole bunch of these guys. They're all hardcore left of center. So that's going to be a problem moving forward, because whatever government comes in, even if it's like a hardcore MAGA government, their laws are just going to get struck down. Mind you, we don't really have too many MAGA guys up here. Like they're all socialists, but don't get me started on that. That's one problem. Another problem is our courts. Justin Trudeau has also packed the federal courts with a whole bunch of bad judges. And I can go into more detail about why that is, but I'll stop there for now.
Have you ever just thought about moving? I know it's very defeatist. You know, I know it's a very defeatist idea, but with all of the kind of insanity, and I'm very glad that you're resisting and fighting back, but have you ever just contemplated? I think that's what Jordan Peterson had to do, but have you ever considered that?
Yes, I have, and I've already done that. I was from Iran. My parents, there was a revolution in 79 and 83, they packed up and left, and I'm going around and I'm telling Canadians, like, patriotism is good, and it's good that you're saying, you know, I will fight till my dying breath to save my country. In practice, it doesn't work like that when the 51% of your country is not on board with you. So when 51% of your neighbors are advocating for destroying the country, even or like 80%, at some point people will pick up and leave. And I've seen it happen. A lot of people with businesses who didn't get the vaccine, who weren't allowed into restaurants, who were ridiculed and mocked and doxxed, they've left. They've gone to the U.S. They've gone to Mexico. They've gone to Costa Rica. They've gone to Eastern Europe. Their money goes, it stretches further. They have more freedom there. And the people, I'm sorry, Canadians listening to this, but they actually have a brain. Like we've just been brainwashed by government for so long here that we believe anything they say.
So since there is such a large concentration of communists, what do you think is the best way to combat that? Would it be more of like a grassroots kind of cultural thing, or what are your thoughts on that?
So first of all, I always say anybody to the left of Thomas Jefferson is a communist to me.
They
don't like it when I say that. So let me tone down the language. They're very statist, like they're collectivist. They believe in the government. It might be like an addict where the country has to hit rock bottom. What I'm seeing right now is capital has been fleeing out of the country since even before Trudeau, like 2014, just before he came in. And then with COVID, people who had businesses are leaving. So you're seeing two things. You're seeing like businesses and investments going down, but like expenditure is going up. Yeah, they're talking about nationalized housing. They call it low income housing. So the government just comes in. And my question is, what happens when all the people that produce leave? Like, who's going to finance these programs? And we're going to find that out in the next few months, because Trudeau did not count on Trump winning. So that's why he was running his mouth, trash talking Trump. And he just figured he could continue racking up this debt forever. But we'll see what happens to Canada. I hope that we don't default on our debt.
And maybe it'll be good timing, because, I mean, we are seeing that here in America. You're seeing all these previous leftists that have been lifetime leftists, and they're shifting right. They're just seeing what I hope that it is, you know, sometimes I speculate that they're just shifting the Overton window. It was so far left that if they just shift it back to the right, basically our modern day MAGA conservatives are just blue dog Democrats from the 80s. You know what I mean? And so I don't know if we make that shift, if that's enough. Like, I think obviously in a very short period of time, you can do a lot of things with the executive orders and make an impact and probably actually have a proof of concept, but will it just be so easy to reverse if the opportunity presents itself?
Trump's a smart guy, and the people that are around him this term are, you know, they're very sharp. Probably what they're thinking is in terms of decades. Like, they're thinking long after, you know, may he rest in peace, Donald Trump leaves this earth. You know, they want to make sure his legacy persists. That's probably why he's taken on this sort of City of London thing. Like, he's basically fighting the globalists. He's trying to bring industry back. he realizes not only does he only have 4 years to implement this, set the foundation, he only has 2 years until the midterm elections. So he's got to make sure he doesn't lose the Senate and the House. But in 4 years, like, he's got to fix the military. He's got to get the industry back. He's got to fix the currency. And something's going on. Like, they're trying to get the transactions out of the City of London above my pay grade. But this war that he started with Canada, I know he doesn't like Trudeau, but this isn't about America versus Canada. This is America versus the globalists.
Yeah, and the other almost impossible task that I see is, and I talked about this with Matt, is about extracting the liquidity out of the economy. Because in my opinion, I mean, it's basic economics, but the only way you can curb hyperinflation, like, there's been so much quantitative easing, and then once they kind of stopped quantitative easing, if they ever stopped quantitative easing, then they started doing these off-ledger bond buybacks. So they've been doing that off-balance sheet so that you don't know about it. And then you have these little subsets of things like the plunge protection team that's adding liquidity to the market. And I think there's so much subversive stuff like that to really create fiscal soundness. There's got to be someone with enough backbone, because if you tried to remove the amount of liquidity, which I don't even know if anybody's ever even calculated that, but when you try to remove the amount of liquidity that has to come out of the market, you know, it will be really bad financially. Since we are now a debt-based economy, it will be bad and it will be slow. It would probably only be for 6 months to a year, but what politician would have the fortitude? And you would have to be a visionary. You'd have to have insight. You'd have to paint the picture of, like, look, this is going to suck really bad, but if we do it right, it should only suck for 6 to 12 months. But that 6 to 12 months is going to be kind of nasty and pretty rough. But when we come out of that very rough period, we could have something like a roaring 20 in our hands.
Yeah, so the word I use to describe this is a house of cards. Like, the amount, I think they're putting in $1 trillion every 3 months. That doesn't seem like if I put in $1 billion into my company every 3 months, you wouldn't say that's a healthy company. The only thing I can compare this to is Ronald Reagan. Like, do you remember when he kept the interest rates really, really high for a long time? And people were really upset, Americans, but they kind of, like, he managed to weather that storm until the economy came back.
That's what really bothers me, because, you know, they started to hike the rate, which is, I mean, that's what the interest rate is there for. The interest rate supposedly is there to control inflation, and then they start to do it, and now they've already paused. I mean, if they're not going to take the liquidity out of the market, they have to, and who wants to, I mean, 12% mortgage, nobody wants to do that. When we bought our first house in 1999, our first mortgage rate was 9.99%, and it was wild. And I remember, you know, shortly after that, within like 3 years, I was able to refi at like 6.75, and it was like, can you believe that? Interest rates are 6.75. These are historically low. They'll never be this low again. Act now, you know? And then they went to zero.
Zero, yeah. It's funny. If you look at Canada, low interest rate environment started in 2001. And if you look at our property market, the property values, they started going up in 2001. Yeah, this low interest rate environment, I think what happened is people were just like, wait a minute, if we can get really cheap loans, we'll just use housing as a form of money, inflation-resistant money.
Yeah, it's exactly what happened. And then what do you know what happened is there was a housing bubble in 08 that seemed to be quite constructed out of that. That's another fascinating thing, if you follow money at all, is they just like destroyed Alan Greenspan. You know, you kept the rate too low for too long, you know, and then ever since Greenspan, I mean, just even this current market bull run previously, like, okay, two major corrections, 99 and 08. You know, they're roughly 9 years apart. And historically, if you ran charts, you could see that 8 to 9 year cycle of a bull cycle, you know, bull versus bear. And now if you look, now we did have an artificial retreat due to COVID, which we could have a really long, great discussion on that, because I think that that was organized to create this whole cash infusion thing, but to prop up this bear market, a market that should go, that should have tanked and should have went bear. And now we just have this immense bull run that's basically, if you draw a line on the chart, it's been since 2009. And that is past historic, and it defies like basic economics.
I did a live stream with Tom Luongo. It's one of your guys down in Florida. The guy was running circles around me, but we were talking about COVID and all the different things. Like one of them was to get Trump out. Another one was depopulation. Another one was, you know, profits for Pfizer. But one of them was that, you know, the global economy was set to crash without a cash infusion. So they kind of brought it in. I don't quite know where I land on that. My number one go-to is it was basically a theft. So they just went to people. They said, you're going to buy this and all the profits are going to go to one company. But yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm very worried about Trump overextending because he's got this grand vision and he's trying to transfer it over through tariffs. But if you introduce tariffs in the short run, you're going to hurt your own people because they have to pay slightly higher until industry comes back. I just hope that he can weather the storm.
Yeah, I'm very interested. I mean, historically, tariffs sound historically the better way to go. They definitely do increase the cost of goods. To me, tariffs would make more sense if, like, for example, we're going to tariff all these chips, all these processing chips. To me, it would make sense to develop the manufacturing first, right? So develop the U.S.-based manufacturing first and then employ the tariffs, because if not, and that takes time, you know what I mean? Part of the problem why people, you know, the biggest problem with culture as a whole, at least for us here in North America, is we are very much a instant gratification culture. You know, which is why we're a debt-based society and a debt-based economy. Nobody talks about capital. Nobody talks about savings. The average savings rate is, I think, negative now. And nobody has kids or anything because we're an instant gratification, self-absorbed society. And I don't want to go on a rant, but, you know, that's our problem.
We can tie it back to the first thing we opened with. We're talking about getting people off of farms, you know, the assault on farmers. And I mentioned the dairy cartel. What's happened in the farming communities in Canada, they can't afford anymore. They've been basically priced out of the market. So they had to sell their farms and they're moving into the cities. And that's sort of the decline. Like when you're on the farm, you have nothing else to do. You have like eight kids, you know, you're self-sufficient. When you're in the city, you got all these bars and clubs and restaurants. I don't have a kid. I grew up in the cities. So you just put everything off and it's that instant gratification. And I always say that these urban centers, they're like gravity wells, hopes and dreams and money and everything falls into them.
Yeah, that's it. And what do you know? There's this 15-minute city agenda and now you're going to take self-sufficient rural people that kind of just want to be left alone and are kind of set up where they can be left alone because they can kind of care for themselves and manage their stuff. And then you're going to force them out into a 15-minute city where everybody's stacked, packed, and tracked. And, you know, once again, this larger agenda that seems to be, you know, not just here in America and not just in Canada, but everywhere the technocrats are.
Yeah, it's, first of all, like the rural folk, people on the countryside, they distrust government. So from a government's perspective, if they were planning, you know, for the next 20 years, just as a matter of survival, they're like, we have to get rid of these country folk. We got to get them in line. They're too rebellious. They're too independent. But definitely when you're in a city, like you're dependent on someone else, like someone else brings your food. Someone else collects the garbage. Like you've no idea where your energy comes from. When you live on a farm, you kind of know, like, you know where the transformer is. And if there's a problem, you know who to call. You go check the circuit box, everything. Like, you know everything, your septic tank. You're self-sufficient, but not the city.
Yeah, and that's exactly, it's so interesting that you mentioned this because we've talked about this a lot on the channel. And this is the reason why we chose to live a more simplified, intentional life was because when even if you're in like an HOA or a neighborhood, you know, somebody comes and gets your trash. If you want a hamburger, you go to Walmart, you know, and you buy it and you just go to the grocery store and it's magically there on the shelf. And, you know, it's my opinion that the best way to raise children is in this agrarian type of environment where they can be part of the process. They can be part of the work process, especially as rich and as poor as people are. I'm not trying to belittle people that are financially struggling because a lot of people are financially struggling. But honestly, even those people that are financially struggling compared to the 1980s, as far as the stuff they have, not that that's any real measure, but I mean, even most of these people have, you know, a cell phone in their pocket, they have access to the internet, they have all of these modern conveniences that, I mean, I just think when the cell phone came out, the cost of a cell phone was just, I mean, it was an absolute luxury and it cost a couple hundred dollars a month and it didn't even work after that. This is why we chose this agrarian lifestyle where kids can grow up hard, you know, and when I say hard, they can have responsibilities. They can take care of animals. There's plenty of work to do that we as a family can work together to create exponentially, to provide enough food for us, to maybe provide some additional food for our community, whether it's eggs or whether it's beef. We have a small ranch with cows and we sell our beef locally here. And this was all part of our idea. We didn't read any books. There wasn't any blueprints or anything how to do this. So we kind of just have like fumbled our way through it. But I believe that the proof is in the pudding that this works. You know, if you put your kids in a slower agrarian environment, we chose that we didn't want our children to be indoctrinated. So we chose to homeschool them. We wanted to pick the curriculum. We wanted to pick what we wanted to fill them with. And we also wanted to give them opportunities as they were developing to explore their own interests. Because me and my wife, we both went to government school and it was so cookie cutter and like everything is like liberal arts or whatever. So there was nothing for you to that you're like, you know what? I really love that. I want to focus on that because all of our kids, they get these different interests and they dive headfirst into it. And then maybe after 6 months or a year, like, yeah, I don't really dig that much anymore. Or maybe they just keep doing more of it. And they've all just kind of become so addicted to learning, you know, and they can do their homeschool with like 2 to 3 hours a day. And then they can spend 2 to 3 hours a day investing in something that they have a deep interest in and learning. And it just becomes this fascinating experiment in education with these young children that can learn. They're like sponges and they can learn this stuff so quickly. And then just having this environment where you can have what I call like feral kids, like, okay, go outside and the world's your oyster and you can fish in the pond, you can track the deer, you can build the fort in the tree or whatever. And it just gives you such an infrastructure for learning, for resilience. And it's just really been a great ride. And I always recommend not everybody can do that. I understand, you know, but if you have the ability to move to a rural area and you have just a little bit of room to spread out and you have children, I highly recommend it.
The same thing is happening in Canada. After the last 10 years, but specifically the last 4 or 5 years under COVID, people are really disgusted with the urban living and they're trying to find ways to move out. If they have the money, they'll buy an acreage. If they don't, they'll go find some, you know, manufactured mobile home on a plot somewhere, and they're just trying to be free. Also, homeschooling is also picked up here as well. So 10 years ago, it was, you know, you'd be considered, I don't know, a psychopath if you homeschooled your kids. Now, like every fourth, fifth mom is homeschooling. Single mothers are homeschooling. And nobody that homeschools, I've never heard someone say, oh man, I wish I hadn't homeschooled my kid. They really fell behind.
That is great. I mean, and that's a lot of the encouraging things that I take from, you know, 2020 was brutal and there was lots of crazy stuff and there's stuff that's kind of like unexplainable and we're still trying to figure it out. But so much good came from that because a lot of people woke up and it showed them what was important. One, it showed them what was going on in the government school systems, and they tried to get away with this, like, learn from your laptop thing. And then parents are like sitting there with your children and they're like, what is your teacher doing? And why do they get paid? And that's not even with like the disgusting perverted indoctrination stuff. That's just with like common core math. Why are we doing this? You know? And then people just, just took their kids out of school en masse. And that's very encouraging. And we just really want to encourage people. It's such a challenge, you know, because me and my wife, we debated it for a long time. And you just like, I don't want to make my kid retarded. You know what I mean? Like, what if I don't give them the right curriculum? And what if they don't learn fast enough or whatever? And we have six kids, and each one of our kids, they've all had different challenges with learning different subjects and all these different things. And they've all done it at a different pace and a different speed. And it is so fascinating. And while you're doing it, while you're going through it, you're like, oh no, I might have blew it this time. I might have really screwed up my kid, you know? And then they get all the way through it and eventually everything just clicks. And you're like, oh no, yeah, I didn't screw up my kid. Wow, they're pretty awesome. Yeah, they're doing a good job. Wow, they're a productive proponent of society. And so it's really neat. We definitely want to encourage people to choose the option of homeschooling, you know, controlling what they can control and teaching their kids what they want to teach their kids instead of just outsourcing that to the government.
I want to give some insight on how education works in Canada. I suspect it's that you have the same problem in the U.S. with the Federal Department of Education. Before, pretty much every decision was made at the municipal level. And even with unions, the union dues, the union interaction with the teachers was handled municipally. Over time, that power has drifted from the municipalities to our state governments. We call them provincial governments. Now, it hasn't really drifted to our federal government because our form of government is more decentralized. But what happened first is the money, rather than the people in the community spending it on the schools, they had to send it to the government, and then the government sends it back with restrictions. So that was the first problem. The second one is that the whole communist thing I told you about, now they're looking at people and they say, if your property or your home is past a certain value amount, I don't know, 2 million, 3 million, you have to pay an extra tax for education. Like it's insane, like 70 grand a year on top of your property tax. Wow. And that goes outside of your community. It goes to like the more poor communities. So people, they look at this, they're like, A, Why is my son's male teacher have lipstick on, you know? What's going on? And B, they're like, why do I want to still continue living in this country? I'll just sell my house. I'll move to Mexico or Spain or somewhere.
Yeah, man, that's it. What's the average median income in Canada?
At the top of my head, $60,000. I do know that we've fallen way behind the U.S. Right now, the average income of anywhere in Canada is lower than even your poorest state in the U.S.
Wow. And you're just being oppressively taxed out. Yeah, it's amazing that anybody stays there.
But I want to see what happens, because you have two completely different leaders. You have Trump that's unleashing your economy, and you have Trudeau that's handcuffing our economy. You know, they're saying global warming, we're all going to die, so we can't tap our resources. We're going to continue giving you more services, healthcare, education, but we're going to tax you, even though we're not going to let you make money. It's not sustainable.
Yeah, I almost forgot. Every guest on the Fearless
Podcast. I do.
You do. You drink coffee. Okay, so we have. Now, do you use K-cups or do you use like a conventional coffee maker?
I use the one with the filter coffee maker. Not
okay,
the
yeah,
old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we have We have whole bean or ground. Do you grind your coffee or do you...
Whole bean.
Whole bean. And so if it was light, medium, or dark roast, what would you want?
Medium.
Medium roast? Okay, great. I'll make sure that I get you out I'll get with you and get your mailing address, and I'll make sure that you get a bag of coffee so you can check out some of the Texas Boys coffee. And this has just been a great discussion. I appreciate you coming on, investing the time here with us. As we wrap up, two things. Where can everyone find you?
You can go to my website, paymentascari.ca, or you can find me on X. I'm most active. My handle is right down there, @paymentascari.
I'll make sure that I put that in the show notes. And then, Payment, any closing thoughts as we wrap up?
Things appear like there's a lot of tension between Canada and America, but that's all the propaganda machine in Canada, a last-ditch effort by the globalists and Trudeau to appeal to whatever little patriotism they've allowed us to retain in Canada to start a war against Trump. I'd say stay united. You know, we're two neighbors. We share a border. We share a lot of customs and cultures and traditions. And we love our American brothers and sisters.
Well, we love you too, and we appreciate it. I appreciate very much of what you espouse. I would say you're over the target, and I wish you best success in your when does your campaign, when does voting happen for y'all?
Because Canada is a circus, there's no set date. The maximum
really?
There's no set date. The maximum would be November 2026. Hopefully,
so what do you,
we'll
wait a second.
Election.
Hold a second. What do you mean? Like people randomly, I'm going to vote today. Like,
it's really bizarre for Americans to understand, because you have a functioning country and your founding fathers understood that you need to have election date. like this is when we have an election in Canada. They said at some point between today and the next 5 years, anytime the parliament wants, they can call an early election.
So, okay, so at least it will be announced, I guess, right? So you'll know.
At some point between today and November 2026, we will have an election.
Wow, I learned something new today. That is fascinating. How much notice we get?
Usually it's a month. Yeah, they just dissolve it and you get a month to campaign.
Wow, that is wild. Yeah, so you're so much alike us and so different. That is bizarre, but that's interesting. But yeah, Payment, man, this has been great. I appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on. I'll put all Payment's links down below. And we love and appreciate y'all. This is a value for value proposition. If you love what we do, go on over to thetexasboys.com. Check us out over there. See what we have to offer. And we will see y'all in the next show.
Thanks again for having me on.
Thank you.